cooperate and who are co-opted by the system. If you really want change, you have to do something different. That means there has to be more focus on the value of human life, less focus on the value of stock market.
But the blame can't be put all on Corona. 75 of the 100 largest cities in the country saw an increase in fatal shootings in the first quarter of 2020. American poverty and instability have soared since the 2008 economic crisis, but America's disregard for the poor of all colors goes back much further.
The solution remains in America looking into the mirror and seeing the ugly side of who she is and making a decision to change, making a decision about where to put money, making a decision about how much money to be placed, making a decision about holding police officers and other powerful figures in government and in society accountable for their wrongdoing, and really caring for the development of the American people versus those who are at the top of this oligarchy, which poses as a democracy.
The highest year-to-year increase in murders ever recorded across urban America was 13%. 2020 saw an estimated increase of nearly 40%. The decision of the nation's political elites to not release a second household stimulus until after the presidential election is being widely blamed for increasing the unstable conditions which inevitably provoked the record tragedies of 2020. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Turkey started its massive COVID-19 vaccination program after the end of a 14-day testing period by Turkey's Medicines and Medical Devices Agency, which approved the jab. The first shipment Sinovac vaccine, consisting of 3 million doses, arrived in Turkey late last month. Turkey is scheduled to receive a total of 50 million doses. More than 300,000 healthcare workers took the vaccine across the country, with data from the health ministry revealing that Turkey has 1.1 million health workers who will be vaccinated within a month from now. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Health Minister Fahrettin Koca and several members of the science board were the first ones to get vaccinated.
We aim to vaccinate all of our citizens as soon as possible. The number of vaccines in the first stage is clear. Now another 25 to 13 million doses will come in the period ahead. We want to continue this rapidly. I get vaccinated as well.
Those who were vaccinated will take the second dose of the vaccine after 28 days.
The coronavirus spread needs to be contained, and the Turkish government has already managed to contain it through various measures. And now, with the arrival of the first batch of the vaccine, it seems that Turkey will be ready to fold this page by the end of February, as the president announced. By that time, everyone will be vaccinated.
Preliminary studies involving more than 7,000 volunteers in Turkey showed corona vaccine to be 91.25% effective. Turkey has reported about 2.34 million infections and around 23,000 deaths. The country has imposed weekend lockdowns and evening curfews to fight the surge in the cases. Turkey is set to carry out the vaccination in four stages, with health workers, elderly, disabled, and adults living in crowded places to take the vaccine in the first stage. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
In March 2015, Saudi Arabia and some of its allies launched a war on Yemen. Their main aim was to throw out the Ansar Allah movement and reinstate former president Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi, who had fled to Saudi Arabia after resigning. The war that so far had killed tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians has been described by the UN as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. But right from the beginning, it was the United States and its Western allies that supported the war in different forms, either by supplying weapons to Riyadh or undermining the situation in Yemen. With only a few days left for US President Donald Trump in office, he is still trying to do the most harm to the Yemeni people and offer political assistance to his Arab ally, Saudi Arabia. On Monday, the US designated Yemen's Ansar Allah as a terrorist group. Washington said the decision will take effect on January 19th, a day before Trump hands over power to his successor, Joe Biden. The move has drawn criticism from the international community and rights groups. UN officials have also opposed the designation, citing humanitarian impact and dire consequences for the peace process in Yemen.
I am extremely concerned about the impact of the decision from the United States to designate Ansar Allah as a foreign terrorist organization. We fear, in my mission, that there will be inevitably a chilling effect on my efforts to bring the parties together.
During a UN Security Council briefing, World Food Programme Chief David Beasley also slammed the decision and called on the US to reverse it.
We are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions.
The US and some other Western countries are major suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia and have been supporting the war on Yemen since day one. Saudi bombardments have already devastated Yemen's infrastructure, turning many schools, hospitals, religious sites into rubble. But the Trump administration never heeded calls by rights groups and politicians inside the US to stop supplying arms to the kingdom. The United States has a history of military adventurism in West Asia. The Saudi-led war is part of a wider American plot to destabilize the region. Will Biden do something to stop the Saudi mayhem or follow the footsteps of his predecessor? That's what the world will be watching in the coming weeks.
The port of Hodeidah, which is the only outlet to the outside world for millions of Yemenis, is still suffering from a forced closure imposed by the Saudi-led coalition. This has caused thousands of workers to lose their jobs, increasing the rate of poverty and unemployment in the coastal governorate.
The workers at the port of Hodeidah include 3,500 workers in the port and 500 others in other fields of the port. They each support a family, and the closure of the port has eliminated the source of income of these people. The suspension of operations of the port has affected the lives of all Yemenis who depend on the port for the arrival of food and medicine.
This port is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis to receive essential supplies, and its continued closure means they can't easily have access to adequate food and medicine, not to mention the large economic losses for the Yemeni economy, estimated at over $1 billion.
The port of Hodeidah is one of the important ports in the Red Sea, and direct and indirect corporate losses are estimated at $1.24 billion in total. This is a large sum, since the Red Sea Ports Corporation is responsible for 70% of the imports sent to the 20 governorates for more than 20 million Yemenis.
Yemen has been suffering from a sea and air blockade since the Saudi-led coalition launched its war in March 2015, which has destroyed the country's infrastructure, killed tens of thousands of civilians and starved millions of women and their children. As the Saudi war on Yemen approaches its seventh year, Yemeni's calls for the demilitarization of Port of Hodeidah continue to be ignored by the United Nations and other relevant international organizations. From Port of Hodeidah, Abdul Latif Al-Washali.
Turkey has the longest continental coastline in the eastern Mediterranean and rejects the maritime boundary claims of Greece and the Greek Cypriot administration in the region. Ankara says these claims are excessive and violate the sovereign rights of both Turkey and Turkish Cypriots. The EU decided on punitive measures against Turkey last year after Ankara asserted its rights in the region by sending several drill ships to explore for energy on its continental shelf. However, the implementation of sanctions has been postponed until March, and Turkey says it is ready to get its relationship with the EU back on track in 2021.
We are inviting Greece, which has been increasing its airspace violations and unlawful activities in islands that are demilitarized, to give up their actions that are raising tensions. I believe that the exploratory talks with our neighbor Greece, which will start on the 25th of January, will, God willing, herald a new period.
European diplomats have signaled the dispute between Turkey and Greece is of paramount importance and also that progress has already been made.
What I have felt from my discussion with the minister Mevlut Cavusoglu is progress has been made too. both in the way of relations between Turkey and Greece, and in relations between Turkey and Cyprus, and in relations between Turkey and France, to give you some examples.
Another issue high on the agenda for talks is Turkey's EU membership bid. Negotiations began in 2005, but have since come to a standstill. Erdogan says Turkey's membership will be a good thing for the EU, now Britain has left the bloc.
Uncertainties that are increasing with Brexit can only be dissipated with Turkey receiving its rightful place in the European family. We, as a country, are ready to put our relations back on track and create positive agendas with a long-term perspective.
In recent talks, Turkey has been quick to remind the EU of its dependence on Ankara when it comes to preventing hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants from trying to cross into European nations. Turkey says by taking initiatives in places like Syria and Libya, it is contributing to the EU's security considerably and is calling on the bloc not to allow disputes with individual members like Greece and France to jeopardize that. Bianca Rahimi, London.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This is the old theme song of the kids' program. When I was a child, I used to sit before TV every day, so impatiently to watch the kids' program. Oh, well, childhood memories never disappear. Sometimes a sound, a scent, or even an old photo take you to the memorable past. Today I'm going to take you to a very memorable place, to Iranak Museum of Childhood in Tehran. Iranak Museum of Childhood is the outcome of almost 20 years of research on the history of children's literature. This museum is located at the National Library and Archives of Iran. In addition to being appropriate for all children's age groups, Iranak Museum of Childhood takes adults to their childhood memories as well. This museum recounts the importance of childhood history and culture from thousands of years ago until today. This place is not founded for the purpose of visiting old tools. Rather, this collection is aimed at providing an atmosphere for people for being a child or even going back to childhood by presenting narrations, stories, plays, or games so that people are more interactive and engage in new common experiences. Introducing the prominent figures who have worked in the area of children is one of the other purposes of founding this museum. I am now at the Iranak Museum of Childhood. Just in front of me, there is a showcase which its content is amazing. Ah, the replica of children's board of exercise for 4,000 years ago. Can you believe it? The original version of these boards are being kept in National Museum of Iran. On these boards, there are sentences written with cuneiform characters, which reads, wise man, and also little wise man. This part of the Iranak Museum of Childhood displays the toys which used to entertain Iranian kids since very old times. This is sutsutak, a kind of whistle which is made of clay. And these are the statues of animals which children used to play with them. Look at these rattles. Very cute. I wish I could hear their sound. In this museum, pieces of music or songs suitable for children are played. Can you hear? It takes me to my childhood. Oh, look at here. There are children's magazines. These magazines are fantastic. And here, there are newer magazines which we are allowed to touch and turn over the pages. These magazines are very memorable. And in this part of the Iranak Museum of Childhood, there are tools which were used for taking care of infants and babies at those times. Things like a cradle, wooden saddle, which is a traditional kind of cradle, feeding utensils, and hygienic stuff, which are really old. And in this part, there are discovered graves of children with the age of 3,000 years. Ah, life and death are twin brothers. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, perhaps the beginning of this millennia gave us a sneak peek at what would come 20 years later in the United States. The inauguration of George W. Bush was met with protests and those saying, "Hail to the thief," when the president passed, referring to the controversial election of 2000, where many believe Al Gore had won and that there was manipulation of the vote. The president's car was egged, but with the way things are standing, that was nothing compared to what may happen this Wednesday for President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. All eyes are on Washington, D.C., as a nation divided gets ready for a new president that half of the electorate does not accept.
Washington, D.C., the U.S. capital city, preparing for the inauguration of the next president on January 20th. However, what is most noticeable across the city is heightened security. Roads around the White House are blocked. Many public areas and businesses closed off until after the inauguration. Capitol Hill is being guarded by police, National Guards, and other law enforcement officers. In order to move between the White House and the Congress building, citizens need to pass through strict security checks. Officials are even pushing for more security.
We have a special responsibility that there is a peaceful transition of power in our country. We're proud in Washington to host the federal government, and we want to make sure that event is peaceful.
Tensions are running high in light of the January 6th seizure of the Capitol building by supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump. Earlier this week, the House of Representatives impeached Trump for inciting what it called the insurrection that left five people dead. A police officer was among those killed. U.S. intelligence reports gathered from social media platforms suggest that authorities are tracking thousands of new threats against politicians ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration ceremony. These threats include calls for the assassination of Democrat lawmakers, usage of explosives and weaponry, and million militia marches. Former FBI Director James Comey has also warned of a very serious risk of violence during Biden's inauguration. D.C. citizens are very concerned, too.
It's the biggest security threat, internal domestic security threat, we've ever had since our Civil War. Of course, I think that that's a huge security threat.
More than 25,000 National Guards have been deployed to Washington, D.C. The Pentagon says they are authorized to carry weapons and make arrests to provide security. other American state capitals are on alert too. Trump's final days in office are also marked with political tensions in different layers of the U.S. government. The Senate is clashing over his impeachment trial. The House is calling for the prosecution of the lawmakers accused of helping in the Capitol Hill unrest. That comes as Vice President Mike Pence is trying to fulfill Trump's duties. Trump has even refused to participate in the inauguration of his successor, Biden. All these make the swearing-in of the 46th president of the U.S. a ceremony like no other in the American history.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Daniel Lazar, author and journalist out of New York, and Netfoot Freeman, Coordinating Committee, Black Alliance for Peace, out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with us, starting it off in New York. And Daniel, well, in an unprecedented move, 25,000 National Guard troops are on high alert in the U.S. Capitol. Do you think that with this type of show of force that those opposing to Biden's presidency could still pose a threat?
Presumably not in the Capitol itself, but there could be a threat in the state capitals. Remember, America has 50 separate states and 50 separate state capitals. So it's possible that something could happen in one of the state capitals. But regardless of what happens on the 20th, this problem is not going away. It's only going to intensify. American government suffered a body blow on January 6th. The system is just reeling under the impact. And the breakdown will accelerate. I am quite confident.
Well, Netfa, do you consider the current scenes in D.C. ironic, as there are checkpoints and secured regions now, just as the U.S. have set up in Iraq and other countries it has occupied? However, this time it is at home, and I know that you are in Washington, D.C., actually. So your take on this?
So I guess it would be one word. That what just happened January 6th was the beginning of it. This country and then this government is facing a serious crisis of legitimacy, not just from these openly racist right-wing people, but a lot of people, as a result of it being the bipartisan pursuit of neoliberalism, austerity, low wages, privatization, deindustrialization, and this. Actually, one of the things that's missing, or the overlooked consequences to the population, are the are working class, non-black working class people, non-white particular working class people. When this militarization and this basically almost tantamount to martial law condition persists, it's going to be us also trying to get real social justice, not this stuff that they're protesting now, that are going to have to reap the consequences of this. Big tech is also involved, and the national security state is shoring itself up. People aren't really looking at this because it's so Trump. There's a lot of reasons to be able to hate him, and there's a lot of reasons to not like white supremacy and naked racism. But at the same time, the bipartisan, both leadership of parties really adopt and are committed to white supremacist capitalist neoliberalism, and they are both committed to that. So while the non-white working class folks don't really have a dog in this show, we are going to reap some serious consequences as a result of the shoring up of the national security state.
Well, Daniel, as I said in my introduction, last year's election is not the first controversial one, but in 2000, Al Gore conceded for the sake of the country. However, Trump has said that the reason why he and his supporters have stood up is basically to save the country, and his supporters really feel that they have a responsibility to stand up in order to save the country. So what do you do with this type of mentality and trying to keep security in the country?
Well, I mean, it's not just a mentality. The political structure is breaking down. And when it breaks down, people, find themselves part of the rubble. They try to figure out what's going on, and they start fighting with one another in a completely chaotic and confused manner. But the structure itself is breaking down. The problem has been building since the mid-1980s. It turned really acute in the year 2000 when we had a stolen election by George W. Bush. And since then, it's been the decay has been intensifying. And under Trump, there was virtually open civil war in Washington. And then on January 6th, that virtual civil war turned into a real civil war when Trump sent his forces to invade Congress. So the machinery is in complete breakdown. The system is in tatters. And you know, it's this old story of Humpty Dumpty. I mean, once he falls off that wall and shatters, there's no putting him back together again.
Well, Netva, now, some analysts say that after that day is when the country, after inauguration and day, and the country has been on alert, we've heard that the D.C. mayor say that the security upgrade is not going to go away after inauguration day. What do you make of her comments? And are we going to see a whole new United States with the way she's talking?
We will see new things. I think this is all still, again, part of the national security state. And people, I mean, I think it's a mistake for us to make this about one person and to only focus on the naked racism. This is a settler colony. And as the even the global economy, not just the U.S. economy, heads down this track of unsustainability, it's reflected in the elite's option to repress and increase repression. These folks that are in the leadership of particularly the Democratic Party or Republican Party that seem to claim to be opposed to Donald Trump didn't oppose it when he, and during the increase of the National Defense Authorization Act, increasing that budget, increasing budgets to police, increasing the military budget, as we mentioned earlier before, we alluded to how these very conditions, the United States facilitates these conditions in other countries, troops and checkpoints and occupation forces, and now it's coming home to roost. But African black communities and also indigenous American communities have all already faced fascism, have been facing fascism ever since the founding of this country. And so it's not that it's new, but it's intensifying, and that's a very concerning thing here. I think we make a big mistake if we opt to support one side of the ruling class over the other that have none of our interests at heart.
Well, Daniel, not only is the U.S. experiencing massive number of troops on the ground in all 50 states and Washington, D.C., but at the same time, there has been a major crackdown on the internet of those who do not support Biden. What do you make of this new current state of affairs in the U.S.?
Well, there's definitely an intensifying security atmosphere. There's no doubt that that the internet is being tightened up. There are going to be greater restrictions, and those restrictions, of course, will end up coming down more heavily on the side of the left and the right, because that's always the way it is. Look, America is not a fascist state. It is not a fascist state. But it is definitely heading in that direction. And if it ever does reach that point, then Americans will get a firsthand lesson about what fascism is really about. And it's not going to be pretty. But repression is intensifying, the breakdown is accelerating, and the more the breakdown accelerates, the more you will see outrightly fascist elements coming to the fore. So the process, we're not there yet. But the process is certainly speeding up.
Well, Netva, you were laughing when Daniel said it's not a fascist state. Your take on that, I mean, is the U.S. becoming a police state?
Well, I think what's really necessary is important for us to analyze things from the point of those who are settler colonized. This country was founded by attempting to exterminate and commit genocide against indigenous people and bringing enslaved Africans here. And the conditions for those people, those populations here in the United States, have been quite particular and distinct from other populations here. And what we experience, particularly when we bring in the class element of it, is identical to what we would define as fascism. So when we say it's not a fascist state, well, maybe it's not for some, those whose interests, who even can take advantage of the democratic machinery like votes and things like that, which in this country is very suspect, has always been. And then those who are more adversely impacted by the policies of neoliberalism and whatnot, these policies against narrowing the range of political thought through the big tech companies and censorship of participation is also not even new to us. What they're doing against Donald Trump and all that, you know, they've already started doing against our movements and using the big tech companies and the social media to surveil our movements. And these are not new to us. So when we say things, it's not a fascist state, I mean, I guess we would have to, we just have to look at the conditions of fascism that some people have invariably had to face in this country for a long time.
So what you're saying, Netfa, is that it is unique that now perhaps it's being targeted against each other, as opposed to what you were saying that before it was actually used against African-American communities and indigenous community there, correct?
Exactly. What's new is that, this has been coming, it's been quite a time coming, is that the right-wing race, openly racist, because I would say that assert that the ruling class in general is white supremacist and patriarchal and classist, but the naked ones, the ones who will just be open with it, are also now against the government and don't see the government as representing, for various reasons, itself. And so that's new, and that they will be doing, they're doing now the things that they're doing. But for the rest of us, and the fact that this neither side of the ruling class or anyone who benefits from this settler colonial paradigm in this country, none of them have our interests at heart. And this long-term consequences of this shoring up the national security state are going to we're going to have to bear the brunt of that, and that has to be recognized.
Okay. Well, Daniel, the incoming Biden administration has already talked about giving legal status to around 11 million people in the U.S. Who are there illegally. Now, this is an issue that Trump and his followers have been especially vocal about. This move is likely to add even more fuel to the fire. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the fires will burn ever hotter. And I think whatever Biden does, he will wind up adding fuel to the fire. He's caught between a rock and a hard place. Biden will try to institute certain reforms. He will also institute certain repressive measures, surely. But whatever he does, the crack that has opened up in American society as of January 6th will only grow wider and wider. As I said, American society is falling apart, and there is no putting it back together under present circumstances, given the present mechanisms of government. So therefore, the problems can only intensify.
What do you think, Netfa? Do you think that Biden will be able to bring this divided nation more together?
No, I mean, it absolutely cannot. I mean, and it's not really just about, you know, if we look at things systemically, Biden, the Democratic Party, all of them are committed to capitalism and neoliberalism. They're not committed to things that will really help most people in this country are for Medicare for all, for universal health care, for the various, they're not for bailing out big banks and the type of policies that have been even during the pandemic have seen the biggest transfer of wealth to the rich. And so they're committed to those things. So some of the band-aid things that they profess to do, some of them they might do, some of them they won't. Some of them they're, you know, glad to have blockage from from their so-called opposition in the Congress and the Senate. We'll be able to blame it on them. Right now, they'll have a hard time doing that since they both control both Congress and Senate, Democrats. But ultimately, the types of things that will alleviate the pressures and the tensions that regular people face will not be pursued. Ultimately, they still pursue, you know, exorbitant amounts, will continue to exorbitant amounts to the military, and then tell people that they can't fund their schools or their health care or those kind of things. So they'll be killing other people around the world and then neglecting and repressing the domestic population. That's going to continue under Biden.
Well, what about that, Daniel? Do you think that, though, with the situation being so heavily divided, that the Biden administration will ultimately be made to make certain changes, as our guest in D.C. was saying? The majority of Americans actually want offer medical care throughout the country. They want to spend less money on the military. They want to see the infrastructure of the country actually revised because it's antiquated. Do you think that they will be forced to actually go more towards these type of moves than just representing the 1%?
No. No, I do not. I mean, Biden is a very conservative, middle-of-the-road guy. He's an imperialist. He believes in a strong military. He believes in helping Wall Street first and foremost. He told a group of wealthy campaign contributors back in 2019 that if he was elected, nothing would fundamentally change. And that is what Biden stands for. And Biden has promised to veto a Medicare for All bill. So anyone who really hopes for any kind of, you know, a significant progress under a Biden presidency is going to be disappointed. Biden is one of the most mediocre men to ever enter the White House, and he is also one of the most narrowest in political terms.
And Ned, for your take, what will it take to bring about the changes that are needed in the United States?
That's a good question. It takes a very strong grassroots movement that can find a way to build formidable alternatives to the duopoly, which we refer to as the capitalist Democratic and Republican parties. We need to be very sophisticated and be very mass. We also need to build at least temporary survival programs, pending the radical changes that we need to have, things that will help people survive and get through this, but at the same time challenging the political system. Things like abolishing the Electoral College should be on the table, and do it now before the next 4 years comes up where people are caught. And then, pressing, doing things like forcing, getting these politicians to, right now even the progressive ones are becoming more right-wing, but pressing them to be true to their what they suggest, and not holding back, not protecting their careers, but actually making demands versus appeals.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Out of New York, Daniel Lazar, author and journalist, and out of Washington, D.C., Netva Friedman, Coordinating Committee, Black Alliance for Peace. Appreciate both of you being with us. And as always, thanks so much for being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashim. Thanks so much for being with us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new study from Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri, suggests that measuring mitochondrial DNA in the blood of patients with COVID-19 can help predict which patients are at highest risk of severe disease, requiring more intensive care. We now present you an article authored by Wendy Beattie. The piece is titled Rapid Blood Test Identifies COVID-19 Patients at High Risk of Severe Disease. The article has appeared on the front page of Medical Express website. Please stay with us for more of 1DBT's article. One of the most vexing aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic is doctors' inability to predict which newly hospitalized patients will go on to develop severe disease, including complications that require the insertion of a breathing tube, kidney dialysis, or other intensive care. Knowledge of a patient's age and underlying medical conditions can help predict such outcomes, but there are still surprises when younger, seemingly healthier patients suffer severe complications that can lead to death. But now scientists at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri, have shown that a relatively simple and rapid blood test can predict within a day of a hospital admission which patients with COVID-19 are at highest risk of severe complications or death. The study, published in JCI Insight, involved nearly 100 patients newly admitted to the hospital with COVID-19. The blood test measures level of mitochondrial DNA, a unique type of DNA molecule that normally resides inside the energy factories of cells. Mitochondrial DNA spilling out of cells and into the bloodstream is a sign that a particular type of violent cell death is taking place in the human body. Co-senior author Andrew Gelman and Jacqueline G. and William E. Moritz, endowed chair in immunology and oncology in the Department of Surgery, said, "Doctors need better tools to evaluate the status of COVID-19 patients as early as possible because many of the treatments, such as monoclonal antibodies, are in short supply. And we know that some patients will get better without intensive treatments." He noted, "There's so much we still don't understand about this disease," adding, "In particular, we need to understand why some patients, irrespective of their ages or underlying health condition in some cases, go into this hyper-inflammatory death spiral. Our study suggested that tissue damage may be one cause of this spiral, since the mitochondrial DNA that is released is itself an inflammatory molecule." The researchers said the test could serve as a way to predict disease severity, as well as a tool to better design clinical trials, identifying patients who might, for example, benefit from specific investigational treatments. They also said they would like to evaluate whether the test could serve as a way to monitor the effectiveness of new therapies. Presumably, effective treatments would lower mitochondrial DNA levels. Co-senior author Hrishikesh Kulkarni, an assistant professor of medicine, said, "We will need larger trials to verify what we found in this study, but if we could determine in the first 24 hours of admission to hospital whether a patient is likely to need dialysis machine or intubation or medication to keep their blood pressure from dropping too low, that would change how we triage the patient. And it might change how we manage them much earlier in the disease course." The researchers, including co-first authors David Scozzi, a staff scientist, and Marlene Kano, a postdoctoral research scholar, evaluated 97 patients with COVID-19, measuring their mitochondrial DNA levels on the first day of their hospital stays. They found that mitochondrial DNA levels were much higher in patients who eventually were admitted to the intensive care unit, intubated, or died. The researchers found this association held independently of a patient's age, sex, and underlying health conditions. On average, mitochondrial DNA levels were about tenfold higher in patients with COVID-19 who developed severe lung dysfunction or eventually died. Those with elevated levels were almost six times more likely to be intubated, three times more likely to be admitted to the intensive care unit, and almost twice as likely to die compared with those with lower levels. Furthermore, the test predicted outcomes as well as better than existing markers of inflammation currently measured in patients hospitalized with COVID-19. According to the researchers, most other markers of inflammation measured in patients with COVID-19, including those still under investigation, are general markers of systemic inflammation rather than inflammation specific to cell death. Edward Gell-Mann said, "Viruses can cause a type of tissue damage called necrosis, that is a violent inflammatory response to the infection." He added, "The cell breaks open, releasing the contents including mitochondrial DNA, which itself drives inflammation. In COVID-19 patients, there has been anecdotal evidence of this type of cell and tissue damage in the lung, in the heart and kidney. We think it's possible that measures of mitochondrial DNA in the blood may be an early sign of this type of cell death in our vital organs." The researchers also emphasized that the test is quick and straightforward to perform in most hospital settings because it uses the same machinery that processes the standard PCR test for COVID-19. The method they developed allows mitochondrial DNA levels to be quantified directly in the blood, without requiring intermediate steps to extract the DNA from the blood. The technique returns results in less than an hour. Before they can apply for approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, the scientists will need to verify that the test is accurate in a large multi-center trial. They have plans to expand the research to more sites.